Welcome to Future Proof, the marketing podcast from Kantar, the world's leading marketing data and analytics company, and Side Business School, University of Oxford. In each episode, we speak with marketing leaders and share insights to help brands and business leaders navigate the ever-changing marketing landscape and hopefully dispel some myths and misconceptions along the way. I'm Jane Osler, and I'm EVP Global Thought Leadership at Kantar.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So our guest today is Albert Reed, and Albert is a managing director at Condé Nast, and he's also author of a new book called The Imagination Muscle, which we're going to talk to him about today. So welcome to Albert, and just full transparency, Albert, you are my brother-in-law. Yeah, you are. Lucky you. So we're going to be talking about your book today, and it's a fascinating title, a fascinating topic called The Imagination Muscle. Tell us a little bit about the idea behind the book and what was your process behind it?
The idea for the book started a long time ago when I was following a piece of advice that I give in the book, which is read what no one else is reading. And I was reading a book called by someone called Jean-Claude Carrière about film. And he mentioned in his book, he was a writer who worked with Louis Buñuel, and he and the director Louis Buñuel, every night after filming, would have this exercise. They'd go back to their hotel rooms and they would say to themselves, let's have an idea. Let's have an idea for a story. Because if we keep having ideas for stories, we will exercise our imagination muscle. So the idea of the muscle is the imagination of something you can work at, something that isn't just something that's bestowed upon you from above. It's not something that is just God-given and in a way that the classical world thought about it, where they talk about, we get the word inspiration from inspiro, the being breathed upon by the gods, this old sense of the word from the Latin. And really what I'm saying in this book is the imagination is not something, it's just merely fixed in our minds. It's something that has qualities like a muscle. It's something you can work on, you can develop. And in doing so, you will become happier and more alive. That is the essential idea of the book. And then secondly, I, working in Condé Nast, in a media business, in an ideas business, in a business that requires fresh thinking, innovation in the editorial, in the way we run our business, I thought to myself over the years of doing this, how do we remain fresh? How do we have ideas? How do we keep them coming? If you're running a stall selling bananas, you want to make sure that your supply of bananas is secure. So how do we make our ideas, the pipeline of ideas, secure? So those are the two kind of coalescing thoughts that came to me and really inspired the book, to use the word inspiration again. And that is where it started.
So you said you were thinking about where ideas come from. So in your research, in your exploration, where do you think ideas actually do come from? Can we explain how the imagination works?
We can't really explain it. The neuroscientists can point to the firing of the neural pathways. They can see the imagination working. But what we can't do is then reverse engineer it and systemize the idea process. Ideas still seem to come at moments which seem random. But what I'm saying in the book is really that you can identify those moments in your day. You can find those moments when you might be going for the obvious ones are going for a walk or in the shower, but there are other ones too that I've written about in the book, which some of which are pretty quirky. So Nabokov used to have his ideas sitting in a parked car, and the German romantic poet Schiller kept a drawer of rotten apples in his office, and he would breathe deeply from this drawer of apples, which emitted this gas called ethylene. It's kind of crazy. I actually tried it when I was writing the book. I bought a bag of apples from Sainsbury's, and I let them fester under my desk for 6 weeks. And then one day I was very brave, and I took this bag and I breathed in and inhaled this very bitter, toxic smell. And actually, it didn't really work for me. I had to rush to the window and I gagged. But anyway, this worked for him. I tell you what does work for me, which is an idea that I got from studying the lives of these great imagineers, if you want to call them that, is the idea of the waking moment and really the first hours of the day. If you can not immediately check your email and not immediately check the news first thing in the morning, you have this time in your day, which is a very fertile period in my experience, where you're still semi-detached to the unconscious. You're still in this world of this hidden world of your enormous potential. And yet you're also in a semi-lucid world. So I find that very, very beneficial moment of my day. And that is when Einstein said he first really understood relativity. And that's when Walter Scott, the great writer, said this is when the ideas really came upon him and when he had these moments of inspiration.
So it's possible then that, I'm ruining my mornings by looking at Twitter and looking at my phone. Us phone addicts aren't helping us.
You're throwing away treasure, imaginative treasure.
Okay, noted. That'd be a warning to us all. Moving on to sort of work and corporate environments. I mean, you work for a big company. Lots of our listeners will be working for either large global organizations or corporate environments. What does it mean? How do you translate this meaning, this exercise of the imagination into a corporate environment where there are all sorts of, you know, everyday adventures, you know, different pressures facing us? How do we allow time for the imagination to flourish?
Well, I think the first thing you do is, I mean, I would answer this in two ways. One is how you manage other people and how you foster a culture of idea generation. And then the other is how you think about it for yourself. So in terms of managing teams, I always am careful to instill an expectation of ideas and just to make people think that what they need to do is to have ideas. And that is a rather basic thing to say, but I think it's not always a given that you come into work needing to have ideas. And they don't have to be big ideas. They can be big ideas, small ideas. They can be ideas around, you know, magazines or websites in our case, or they can be ideas around how to improve a production process on the factory floor. So really, and it ties in with the Japanese notion of Kaizen, this idea of continued improvement. And if you look at the most successful companies, they are ideas driven. And not only should one encourage an expectation of ideas, but one should also be very forgiving of bad ideas and rather encouraging of bad ideas, because a bad idea can lead to a good idea. And you sometimes need to nurture something that's half formed, because in a meeting, it may just strike somebody else in a different way, and that might bounce into a good idea. And if you look at people like Bezos, they embrace failure. They, you know, Bezos says, if the size of your failures isn't growing, you're not going to be inventing at a rate that can actually move the needle. And if you look at Bezos, if you look at Steve Jobs, if you look at Edison, you know, at the end of the 19th century, these great inventors, these people who are responsible for some of the most successful innovative breakthroughs in our history, actually were consistently failing. And they were, the successes came about through their persistent attempts to try things. So if you look at someone like Steve Jobs, you know, he invented the Apple Mac, and then he had a couple of disastrous inventions. He had the Power Mac G4 Cube and the Apple Lisa, and then he got fired, and then he came back and invented the iPhone. So it's a curious thing where we think successful people are always successful. In fact, they're not. They just keep trying. As one of the things they do is they keep trying. And it's the same with artists. You know, if you look at someone like Auden, the great poet, you know, he said that good poets write more bad poems than bad poets because they keep going and they keep on at it. Same with Wordsworth. Same with David Bowie. You know, David Bowie, who I worship, produced some abysmal music. You know, the Laughing Gnome, followed by Ziggy Stardust.
Not one of the best.
And then it went down again into Tin Machine, and it came up again at the end with Lazarus. So all artists, all business people who are truly successful are comfortable with the idea of failure. But then the other thing that I might say about myself in business is, you know, I've been working in the media for a few years now, and I think what one has to be aware of and has to be attentive to in oneself is a number of things. But I think you have to accept the world around you has changed. And I find myself sitting in meetings and somebody suggests an idea, and I think to myself, oh, we tried that 5 years ago and it didn't work. And then I stop myself because I realize that actually it may work now. The world has changed. Things have come around. And this idea, maybe its time has arrived. And I think also if you get into a position of seniority, the ego kicks in. There's a tremendous need to feel right. And you are paid for being right. And I think that's a very dangerous mindset because, you know, we all think we're making linear progress on the path to wisdom as we rise through a company when we have all the answers and we are teaching younger people. But actually, particularly in the world we're in at the moment, I think the enlightened leader knows that the best ideas are probably coming from other people, and that they may be coming from younger people. Mm. They may be coming from people with different backgrounds, with a different perception. And I think it's really difficult for people of a certain age, at a certain stage in their career, to embrace this idea of being contradicted. And really, that is a very difficult but important lesson to learn. And really, the rewards, I think, in leadership these days go to those with the greatest networks and those with the widest breadth of interests and those confident enough to test their own assumptions. And I say in the book, the hallmark of a successful person is to be able to imagine that they could be wrong.
Very good. We often talk in market research and in insights about the need to test and learn. You know, it's a continuous process. Mm. So that ties in very well with that. But I think your advice to people to listen to others and absorb new ideas is very good.
Can I add one other thing? I mean, to retain, the other way of putting it is to retain the mindset of a beginner. I think if you have something going on the side in your life where you are a beginner, I think it makes an enormous difference to your day job. What I found fascinating in this book when I was researching the imagination muscle was when I discovered that Nobel Prize winners in science had a disproportionate tendency to have a side interest in art. They were artists, they were musicians, Einstein played the violin. Someone like Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin, was also a very bad artist. He painted in his spare time. He was a member of the Chelsea Arts Club. And he, through his painting, one can't help, and there's another example, Richard Feynman, who won the Nobel Prize in 1965, the particle physicist. He was also an artist. And I think what happens is you get this lightness of being a beginner. And that
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Replaces the heaviness of success and the heaviness of experience. And I find that such a fascinating concept that really being a beginner is a very necessary attribute to the brain when you get, particularly as you go along in life.
So presumably it speaks to the idea that actually you're continuously learning and you're willing to be open to new ideas.
Yes, and you're able to be crap at something. The humility that brings with it, and that curiosity to get better, is driving the imagination muscle.
So we can all try and be polymaths potentially in our lives. I want to move on to talk about one example that you give halfway through the imagination muscle, which is where you write about Hamilton the musical, hip-hop historical yes. biography. And I'm super interested in that, firstly, because I've been to see it loads of times and I think it's really interesting and I love the lyrics and it's just super clever. It also, there's a point in there, though, where you talk about how Lin-Manuel Miranda has drawn on different ideas from history and from music. And let's talk a bit about that and talk a bit about whether you think there is such a thing as an original idea.
What I want to do in the book is try and penetrate the notion of originality and really shine a light on these works of supposed great originality and ask ourselves, what does it mean exactly to be original? And I write about Shakespeare and I write about Picasso and I write about Gutenberg and the printing press. And then I write about Lin-Manuel Miranda. And what I'm saying is, here's Hamilton, this wildly original. You know, all the reviews said this is the most original thing they'd ever seen. And of course, they were right in a sense. And it's a marvelous, brilliant work of musical theatre. But within this musical are a number of very unoriginal ideas. He follows a lot of the musical conventions. You know, the narrator, Aaron Burr, is as the narrator as Nemesis is directly copied from Jesus Christ Superstar, where Judas Iscariot and narrating the story of Jesus, and you have Amadeus, you have, you know, Salieri telling the story. So he takes that idea. He takes the idea of a chorus from Sweeney Todd telling the story at the beginning of the musical. You have, which again goes back to Greek chorus, ancient Greek plays, Euripides, Sophocles. So you have all these kind of theatrical tropes that are in there. But then he layers in hip hop and rap, and he layers in this big, dense biography of Hamilton by Ron Chernow. And what he's doing is original in a sense, and he's recombining lots of existing elements. And he has this, what I call this imaginative palette. He has this ability by reading what no one else is reading, going back to the beginning of this conversation, having this diversity of sources and bringing together in a way that nobody else had ever done. I don't think anybody in the history of humanity had ever had this combination of things in their minds at the same time, which then fused to make this brilliantly original musical. And so he could see what no one else could see. And that was by reading what no one else was reading, listening to what no one else is listening to, and just having this synthesis of disparate thoughts coming together in one place.
So I think that's good advice for, well, sort of insights on people and marketers who might be listening to this podcast as from your book is do things that nobody else is doing and get influences from elsewhere. And in a way, I guess what you're saying is that, you know, we're all sampling, aren't we, if you use a sort of music term. Trying to think of new ideas is a combination of what has gone before, with other influences, that think ingredients that other people may not have put together before. Is that what you completely, your thesis
yes,
is?
Yes, completely. And I think one shouldn't be too, I think one should feel, I'm talking very particularly in the case of artistic work, but feel able to borrow, not in an illegal way, but in a sampling way, ideas from other people. The other idea I mentioned, the other example I talk about is the beginning of Star Wars and C-3PO and R2-D2 walking through the desert at the beginning of the film. And that's taken directly from a Japanese film by Kurosawa called The Hidden Fortress. And it's exactly the same story. In that case, it's two Japanese farm workers about to be caught up in an epic battle. One of them is tall and the one is short. And it's the tall Japanese farmer who complains the most, the C-3PO figure. And so you get this direct lift that George Lucas would you know, he talks about it very openly. And yet Star Wars is this wildly, supposedly original piece of work. So I think, you know, you start with something, the framework that somebody else might lend you, and then you build something delicate on top of it. And then over time, perhaps the framework can be taken out carefully from underneath and you have a new entity of your own.
So let's move on to the topic of, inevitably, the topic of technology and artificial intelligence. So how does the concepts of creativity and imagination and technology and artificial intelligence all collide? Because presumably we're living in interesting times now for ideas, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And I think there are two ways of looking at it. I think there's a pessimistic view and an optimistic view. I think the pessimist would say that AI is taking over more and more of the imaginative, creative work going on at the lower end of the hierarchy, whether it's, you know, adverts, music for adverts, or whether it's copywriting for catalogs. And AI is like this rising tide that's at our feet and coming up to our knees and gradually will take over the whole of the imaginative activity. And there are all sorts of problems with that. If that's the way you see it, if you're a composer and some of the basic work of a composer is taken away, why would you try and do something new when what is adequate seems to be sufficient? So I think there's a sort of adequacy problem with technology, in that it gives you something that's good enough. And you see this in a way with Hollywood sequels, where the top 10 films of 2022 were much like the top 10 films of 1996. So, and then there's other evidence suggesting that chord progressions are getting safer in music, and music is going this way of Hollywood sequels, where you just get this something that's reassuringly familiar but a little bit different. But I think there's also an optimistic view of AI and the imagination. I think at the moment, you know, the human asks the question and AI helps the question to evolve, and it tries multiple connections for us. And throughout this, the human mind is still the curator, and it gives you enormous power to do things that might have been beyond you as an individual before, whether it's special effects or a film, or whether it's creating a video game. These things can now be done, or soon will be able to be done, with AI in a much more cost-effective way. So I think there's something here that is really exciting for the creative industries. I don't think AI will replace the imagination, but I think, and it may not take your job, but it's possible that your job will be taken by somebody else using AI. So I think it's incumbent upon people to use AI and to understand it if they're in the creative industries in their particular field. I think the real question is, we're still framing the questions. When we type the questions into ChatGPT-4, it's still asking the right questions. And what the question about the question is, can AI ask the question? Can it ask a question that's both important, and is it one, and can it ask a question that a human couldn't answer?
There's a really interesting chapter in your book, Albert, about cities and also about offices. So can you talk about how cities affect ideas, how things are built? How does that affect the imagination?
Well, one of the things, the way that the book covers the imagination is parts of it are focusing on what's happening on the inside, and part of it is talking about what happens on the outside. So I talk about coffee shops and clusters and groups of people coming together as a great engine of great rocket fuel for the mind, and really the great geniuses of history, whether it's Shakespeare or Darwin or Steve Jobs, they tended to come out of clusters of groups of people. They were surrounded by other geniuses or brilliant minds who lifted them up. So I think the idea that I'm really trying to put forward is that we can't operate in a vacuum, and ideas happen as a result of being with other people. On top of that, we are living in a world where we predominantly occupy an urban environment. The number of people living in the city exceeds the number of people living in the country. So that's something we have to bear in mind for the future. And we have more and more people living in cities. The global city dwelling population is projected to increase by 2.5 billion people before 2050, with most of that growth coming from Asia and Africa. And China alone is on course to build 300 cities, new cities, each of over 1 million people over the next 25 years. And so what we have to think to ourselves is the large majority of ideas are going to come from people living in cities. And so we have to think about cities in a different way, in my view. We have to think about cities not only as places full of buildings that shelter us, but also places where we feel safe and places which inspire positive emotions, but also places that inspire the imagination. And I say in the book, I say the people sitting around, the architects and the developers and the city councillors and the town planners, they should be sitting around saying, the imagination feeds growth. Ideas are our salvation. So how do we design a city above all for ideas? And really, my line is that nothing is as important and urgent as this question. If the imagination is going to propel us into the future, a city for ideas is the foundation. And going back a step, the story that I tell is one of Corbusier, who was this great modernist architect and city planner at the beginning of the 20th century, who really thought that doing away with the cobbled streets and the mixed up alleyways and the town squares should be replaced by tower blocks and parkland. And he came very close to knocking down the center of Paris, the Marais district. And what I'm saying in the book is ideas coming out of cities tend to come out of the cobbled together bits, the souks of medieval Islam and the back alleys of Renaissance Florence and Greenwich Village and Notting Hill and the back streets of Tokyo. This is where we all want to be. And yet we still haven't really grasped this fundamental fact. And when you look at the latest town planning, you get some very good examples of where this is understood. I think the King's Cross development with Thomas Heatherwick is a very good example of that. But there are also plenty of terrible examples where tower blocks are still crammed together, and these are not cities being designed for ideas.
You've been listening to Future Proof from Kantar and Side Business School. For all episodes and more information, visit kantar.com or oxfordfutureofmarketing.com. If you enjoyed this, please leave a rating and a review and subscribe on your favourite podcast app so you never miss an episode.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.